welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, I connect the dots between everything going on in our personal world of well-being, our communities, our neighborhoods, our society, with what's going on in the bigger picture, in the policy decisions and choices that we make as a society that impact both us as individuals, as well as our communities, our society, and the state of the earth. We've been doing this on Connect the Dots since about 2010, and coming around to, I guess it must be my 7th or 8th year anniversary this in the next 2 months. And the whole goal of the program, which is to help us look at the big picture and get, you know, when we look at health, when we look at survival, when we look at viability, we also have to look at things like energy policy, democracy, the state of the earth, and a lot more beyond where I began as a health journalist and where Gary Knoll, founder of this network, also began as a health journalist. Beyond the immediate choices that we make about our personal health, we need to look to societal choices. So, you know, we've been doing that on this show for, you know, 7 and going on 8 years at this point, and it's never been more needed or more relevant. So I just want to give a shout-out of thanks to my listeners and to all the fantastic guests that we've had on the show in the past. We regularly feature journalists, advocates, thought leaders, experts, scientists, doctors, filmmakers, documentarians, book authors, and a whole host of other folks that shed light on different aspects of all of this. Right now we're in a sea change in our society with the recent election, some of the doubts about it, and you know, also what's coming up in what looks like it will be, bar various possible interventions, you know, the next presidency. And so we're looking ahead to, you know, what is going to be going on in that domain with the president-elect Donald Trump and his prospective nominations for key cabinet positions. As regular listeners of this show know, I'm one of the very first reporters to start covering fracking back in 2009, and this coverage of fracking, pipelines, climate, nuclear, energy policy, climate policy, and all the rest of it is a large feature of what we track on this show. And that's why I am beyond delighted to have with us today journalists that you know, is really high on the top of my list in covering the same terrain. I'm so delighted that Steve Horn of DSmog Blog is joining us today to discuss what the prospects are with the coming administration. Steve is a freelance investigative journalist whose work has appeared in The Intercept, yay for that, Vice News, Al Jazeera, Wisconsin Watch, Let's Run, and a host of other places. He's Indiana-based and a research fellow for DSmog Blog. I follow his work very closely because he regularly covers in-depth and investigates every signature area that really is going to be affecting energy policy, environment, and climate. And so we're, you know, I just am so honored to have you with us today on the show, Steve. We're going to be discussing what's upcoming in these terrains in the upcoming administration. Welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, I appreciate that kind introduction. It's good to be on your show. I can't believe I haven't been on yet, but hopefully
I know.
Hopefully more in the future.
Definitely, yeah, because we're really tracking very, very similar things.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, the very same things, you know, and I kind of am more on the front of sort of woman-splaining to people, you know, why we have to pay attention to all of this and what its implications are, because, you know, there's a lot of unclarity, confusion, and disinformation going on in our corrupted media environment, sad to say. So, you know, that's kind of, I just sort of take the same kinds of information. I rely on the work that you do, for example, and, you know, use it to educate, you know, the kind of audience that I address. So, So let's, jump right into it. As we came into the election, throughout the election campaign season, we knew that Donald Trump was a self-declared climate denier. At the same time, we also heard his promises to clean out the swamp, as he put it, in terms of, who he was going to be bringing to Washington. And apparently his definition of swamp doesn't correspond to any hopeful thinking about that, anybody on the libertarian side, for example, or, anyone who kind of was fingers crossed maybe he'll do something good might be, kind of wishing for. Although I know neither you or I were tremendous proponents of his opponent, I'd also like to discuss the marginal, the differences between them a bit on the program, because there is still this, potential for a regime change here in the outcome of the election. Nevertheless, for those who kind of thought he might do something different, this is a big bait and switch in terms of his nominations. And I would say in our area, in the area of energy and environment, they're bad all around, but they couldn't be worse. So let's, I can't visualize how they could possibly be worse. So let's, I don't have a good imagination, So let's talk first about his nomination for the crucial position of Secretary of State, and you've done an article about it. Let's talk about that, his nomination of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson.
It's pretty unbelievable just to even say that, but that's who he picked as his nominee to become the Secretary of State. Indeed, is the CEO and actually soon to be departed CEO, because he's retiring regardless in March from ExxonMobil. So this is like almost from his point of view, it's nice for him. It's his next gig. He goes from basically being the de facto head of the State Department, given how the State Department has for so long served the oil and gas industry in various ways. He goes from the de facto Secretary of State of the United States to the actual Secretary of State of the United States if he gets through Congress, which is actually going to be a pretty rocky road for him because of one central fact, and that is the ties to Russia and Vladimir Putin, which just to put it into some context there, and I don't even think that this is the most troubling thing about, by the way, just not only this is just a caveat, I don't think this is the most troubling reason why Tillerson was picked. I don't think it's because of the Putin ties or the Russia ties, but I think that's going to be the reason why his nomination will be a little bit rocky. And so looking at just the ties to Russia for a second, because that's what's really gobbled up all the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
He back in 2011, so he's been CEO for about a decade, and back in 2011, his company signed a joint venture with the Russian state-owned company Rosneft for drilling both offshore and onshore, it was a broad agreement to work together. And then since then, they've kind of come to terms of what that would exactly look like. And what it's ended up looking like is collaborating on exploration of shale in Siberia, a massive reservoir that's even supposedly could be much more prolific than even the Bakken shale, which is the largest shale basin in the United States in terms of producing oil, at least, up there with the Eagle Ford shale in Texas. So we're looking at, I forgot the exact estimates, but estimates something like between ranges of 50 to 100 times the size in terms of how much oil and gas it could potentially produce. But that's, of course, always the estimates are different than what ends up coming out of once they do drilling. So they're really very much an exploration phase there. And then same for the Arctic. They signed an exploration deal to look at a massive territory. It's 190 million acres, and it spans 9 time zones. So we're talking about both of these together, just a massive, if you're not even looking at it from our perspective, okay, not even from geopolitical, whatever the people in Washington, D.C. are talking about, but just looking at it from a climate change perspective, this is a massive carbon bomb, this sort of exploration agreement that these two countries, Exxon signed with state-owned company Rosneft. And then there's some other smaller deals they signed together in the United States, including some offshore drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, some fracking in the Permian Basin in Texas, and then some offshore collaboration in the North Slope of Alaska. So all of those are part kind of got enveloped in this deal to work together. But what ended up happening, of course, is that stuff blew up geopolitically with Crimea and Ukraine. And since then, sanctions were put into place. And so now Rosneft cannot actually work with Exxon because Exxon is not allowed to be doing business with a Russian company. So that's been put on hold for the past couple of years. And what many people think is if he does become Secretary of State, sanctions will be reversed and these deals are back in place and the exploration continues. And of course, just from a climate change perspective alone, which I don't feel like has been emphasized quite enough given the gravity of it, it's pretty frightening just looking at the carbon bomb that could potentially be unlocked. Of course, they're still in exploration phase and they're not actually going to start drilling like crazy yet, but still they're looking at the prospect of drilling. And that's only Russia alone. Of course, Exxon has operations literally all around the world. It's been dubbed a quote-unquote private empire by investigative journalist Steve Kahl. So they have operations literally pretty much everywhere around the world, more or less. And so he has developed, that's why he's been sort of touted as this guy. Oh, he has those connections to the perfect candidate to become Secretary of State, as his proponents say. And so
Let me just ask a question about that, because for people who, were born back in the last century or whatever, but I mean, how is it? I just want to back up because, what you're saying, that the assumption that this is the role of the Secretary of State, how did this come to be the role of the Secretary of State back in the day? And, I hope I'm not dating myself, but I'm sure I'm not alone in that a lot of people listening to this would imagine that the role of the Secretary of State would be things like, diplomacy, stepping into the middle of various international situations, maintaining good relations with foreign countries, perhaps negotiating on behalf of American hostages, getting intelligence of potential activity against, endangering Americans and that kind of thing. All of that would be under the realm of what I think would be given in most people's minds as an assumption. This is what the Department of State and the Secretary of State are about. It's about diplomacy. How did it become about this? When did this happen?
So it's always been a little bit a part of what the State Department does. I would say that, I wouldn't even say a little part. I mean, it's been among the things in its portfolio, it's been a major part of what it's done for a long time, but it became increasingly so a major part of what they do and an official part of what they do, believe it or not, under who could have been the president, which is under Hillary Clinton's State Department. It became an official part of what they do called the Bureau of Energy Resources, in which they devoted many staff members to quote-unquote energy diplomacy, which was ended up becoming a large part of that was a separate bureau called the Global Shale Gas Initiative, in which they were trying to get other countries around the world to invest in fracking, basically, or invest in developing the prospect of potentially doing fracking. And so they were selling fracking around the world in places like particularly Eastern Europe as, ironically enough, a means of fending off Russia and trying to sort of curb the power of Russia as an energy power. And so now we're going to see a kind of probably a sharp reversal of that, in which actually the State Department will be emboldening Russia, or at least emboldening Russia's energy industry to work alongside companies like Exxon and others. But it, yeah, it became official part of the State Department's mission, really. The thought of it started under the Bush administration. There was some legislation put forward to create this position by Richard Lugar, who's actually from Indiana, but it didn't pass. It passed around that time. It didn't actually get implemented until Hillary Clinton's State Department and the guy who ran it by the name of David Goldwyn, who was a longtime guy who's been, you know, a lawyer and consultant for the oil and gas industry, headed up the first Bureau of Energy Resources and Global Shale Gas Initiative. And so it's still part of the State Department, even though Hillary's gone under John Kerry. I expect it to become an even more robust part of the State Department if Rex Tillerson is at the helm, just by its very nature. I mean, we're talking about oil and, you know, a CEO of an oil giant. I do expect that that part of the State Department will grow immensely.
Let me just comment on that briefly because, you know, here there are two different kind of things or anomalies. Obviously, it's tremendously concerning that Trump is wanting to put this guy in this position. But what you're also tracing for our listeners is the fact that this is already the setup and has been,
right,
as you know, through several. You know, it was kind of put in place in the Bush administration, and we see a lot of these things where something is put in place that then blooms in a later, administration of the opposite party. Then this was actually instated in the Democratic administration under Obama with Hillary Clinton at the helm, and now it's moving forward and accelerating yet again. So, you know, on the one hand, this kind of belies the sense that many liberals have that, you know, it's like, you know, if it's kind of a leapfrog game where each party kind of, when in power, continues in the same direction, you know, doing more of the same thing that you know, has been set in place by a prior one, then it's more of a leapfrog than it is two parties, one of which is holding the line and the other one is, you know, trying to run the ball in the wrong direction. So I just want to comment on that. And also what you're describing makes clear the statement, you know, that has been, you know, is kind of the signature statement on the confusion during the recent election about Hillary Clinton's stance, namely that as Secretary of State, she sold fracking around the world. And I think that many people heard that but didn't really maybe fully grasp why, as Secretary of State, that would be, you know, that would be her purview. It just sounded like she was, like, for example, at the Democratic Convention when she was introduced by Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama said that, you know, that at the time Secretary of State Clinton went around the world helping children, you know, implying that she was traveling all over the world on a goodwill tour on behalf of children in some way. And then, you know, in fact, she was traveling. I mean, maybe she did attend some ribbon cuttings at schools all abroad. That's certainly possible. Obviously, this would have been her more primary initiative. And therefore, even though we now have an outright climate denier, you know, it raises the question of how much better off we would have been under a Clinton presidency, or would be under a Clinton presidency if these various interventions.
There's a couple ways of looking at that. I think that, first of all, she personally was not doing, at least that I've seen, not doing, although she was definitely doing some, she was not personally doing a lot of the traveling around the world through this. She delegated that task to David Goldwyn and to his staff. And they would report back if you see all the different emails that came out, both from FOIA. None of the WikiLeaks stuff had anything to do with it. So this was the FOIA stuff that came out before the WikiLeaks. But you mostly see that David Goldwyn would be emailing with other high-level staff, and then they would forward it off to Hillary, because almost no one could talk direct. Like, I guess she was just so busy that the important stuff, they would triage up to her. So she would go on some of the trips, but it would mostly be David Goldwyn. And that's not even to defend her. That's actually almost a little bit more frightening in some ways, because David Goldwyn is a guy who's done lobbying and done oil and gas industry legal work and consulting work for decades. So this is a guy who was really chosen to do this work. He immediately leaves that job after doing it for a couple of years and goes back and does the same thing, becomes go back to the revolving door, becomes a industry attorney, becomes works for industry-funded think tanks, etc. So this was the guy who really spearheaded it. And I think that that's, I bring it up only to raise my second point that even Rex Tillerson, who we're talking about, the CEO of ExxonMobil, he'll have a staff and a staff to do, you know, administer a lot of this work. And I think that just as much as him being the figurehead, him being able to do a lot of traveling around the world, he'll have people doing work for him. And it'll be interesting and important to see what kind of people he's picking. Already, even without an oil and gas industry CEO, oil and gas industry people were being picked for these positions. So it's pretty easy, I guess, to see what kind of people will be hired to do this job by Rex Tillerson if he's picked. And I bring that up, that's the sort of the larger point, is that I think, like, people focus a lot on the figurehead of the State Department, who is obviously an important figure, but there are so many staff members that implement this stuff that have all kinds of their own ties, maybe lesser names, not as covered by the mainstream media, but very important people that implement the policy of that person at the top, a person like Hillary Clinton or a person like Rex Tillerson or a person like John Kerry, et cetera, Condoleezza Rice, you name the person.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you another question. I don't know if you have done the math on this, so I'm going to make it a two-parter, and you can kind of answer part one and then sort of see if you have assessed, you know, the information that would be part of answering part two. One of the things that you're saying about these enormous plays in Russia, I mean, when you say it goes through 9 time zones, I mean, that is just absolutely massive. And then you also pointed out that obviously this is not like all going to be releasing carbon on day one of the next administration,
right.
So it's going to be a process of exploration before they even get to, digging and all of that kind of thing. So, you know, that creates a certain time frame. But taking where we are now with what is the window, or there really isn't that much more of a window, but let's kind of take it from your understanding of where we are now in terms of when the more severe climate impacts might be experienced, to how that over whatever, you know, that new Russian excavation over whatever time frame would be required would increase that. So, for example, I'm just going to speak off the top of my head here, and you could fine-tune it. And if right now we're looking at we're going to have severe impacts in, let's say, 15 to 20 years, you know, would, and then it's going to take them 8 years, let's say, to, you know, kind of get this horrible thing up to speed and kind of moving forward, would that mean that in, you know, in, let's say, 15 to 20 years, instead of it being, like, quite bad but manageable, it becomes forget about it, we're out of here? I mean, I'm just, you know, kind of stating it in a rude and succinct kind of manner. But, like, what's your understanding of where we are now? And if you have one, or if you've, you know, heard of one, what would be the projection on where this would take us? So that we just kind of, you know, get a little more specific about it, rather than doing what, you know, I often do, which is speak of climate catastrophe and all of that kind of thing, which is just a general phrase covering, you know, the effects in this kind of timeline. What is your understanding of that?
Yeah, I haven't seen any great projections on what it would actually mean to tap into all this carbon. That's sort of unfortunate, because I think it would be important to do just exactly what you said, is contextualize, besides just saying that it would be a climate disaster, actually contextualize either how, to sort of the extent of what a disaster it would be. I mean, and I think one, the thing to underline here is that the Arctic is a great example. You couldn't even really think about tapping into that Arctic oil without climate change to begin with. That's example number one of how the oil and gas industry does acknowledge climate change, even if it doesn't talk about it as in the way that we do. They definitely know it exists because they're now profiting from it by doing exploration in the Arctic. There was an article several years ago, sort of a light bulb moment for me, that a professor wrote that he wrote on his own blog, and then it went up on Think Progress, that talked about how Exxon, so Exxon is, of course, the company we're talking about right now, longtime denier of, founder of denial of climate change. But his article was about how Exxon actually does not literally deny climate change, because look at what they're doing right now in the Arctic. And his article was back in 2011 when they were doing some exploration. They're still doing exploration now. But even the underlying concept of them doing exploration in the Arctic is an acknowledgement that this melting, slowly melting Arctic is now a business opportunity for Exxon. And so going to that, I'll pivot a little bit to, we're talking about future impacts of climate change and high, you know, increasingly high global temperatures. But even at present, the melting of the Arctic is causing climate change impacts today, like literally today. We have right now a polar vortex or an Arctic vortex that here in the Midwest has caused temperatures within the last week to plummet like 40 or 50 degrees, no exaggeration, major,
wow.
Yeah, no exaggeration at all. Like last week it was maybe about 40 to 50 Fahrenheit for the high, and now it's high temperatures of 15 degrees, literally a week later, because of the polar vortex, which is engulfing the whole Midwest. And that's because of these polar vortexes, in which in the Arctic it's actually really warm temperatures right now, which is causing all kinds of different weather patterns, especially in the northern Midwest. And so, but all around the United States, things are different right now because of the polar vortex than they would normally be. And so that's, we can see these weather patterns here and now. In the future, with more and more digging up of fossil fuels and you know, our entire system that's based on consumption of fossil fuels, these weather patterns will get more crazy. And there's actually a really good sort of a dystopian show on Sci-Fi Channel, which Matt Damon helped executive produce, that is based on the year 2073, in which it's just interesting because this is where I'm from or close to it. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it's actually the site of climate refugees, like the headquarters of where climate refugees in the United States go, because cities along the coast are underwater because of climate change. Of course, that's a fiction, but it's based on sort of somewhat of reality, in that this is the hole that we're digging ourselves into, and, you know, both in the United States, but globally, with the United States, of course, being, you know, a huge part of the problem, because of we're the leader of these industries, and we're one of the biggest producers of greenhouse gases in the world.
Well, that's
a really
very
roundabout way.
Sobering. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a roundabout way of answering your question, but I think that, it's very hard to imagine the implications of if those deals go forward in Russia, given what's already in place with climate change and what's already been locked in and what's being locked in.
So let me, I mean, this is obviously horrific, and, you know, we'll have you back on the show because, you know, I'm hoping at some point, you know, we really get down to cases on the numbers, because it is so hard to imagine, you know, any change. People are very ill-adapted to any change in our world. You know, we're ill, you know, it's been a huge learning curve and extremely difficult, for example, for liberals, you know, the class that I grew up in, was educated in, et cetera, the class of people, to imagine that, you know, this isn't just a liberal versus right-wing war in which the liberals are always the good guys. You know, I mean, a lot of people have a lot of trouble getting their mind around that because of media influence. Mm-hmm. And it isn't, that isn't to say that there aren't significant differences. But, you know, in the human rights area, we see this, you know, soon-to-be-passed administration doing really bad things, which will then, you know, which everyone kind of ignored because we have a guy we like, and so we, many people feel in the White House, you know, and then it passes along to the next Republican administration, and all those powers are, you know, then put into those people's hands. And we do really have a leapfrog effect, and we're not really kind of, a lot of people don't, can't understand that, even as it happens before our eyes, no less what this is all going to look like as the outcomes of this on climate proceed. So I thank you for that, and we'll have you back on and stay in tune with that. Joe Rahm recently did a piece in Think Progress that, you know, all of this is much closer around the corner than the 150 years from now that people would wishfully imagine, a time frame in which everyone's grandchildren would have left the planet and some distant descendants would be dealing with this problem rather than we ourselves.
Yeah, he's good at it. I'll just highlight that. He's actually very good at kind of talking about climate change in a way that's kind of easy to understand without glossing over how the gravity of the problem. He talks about it in a very real way, but also in a way that is easily graspable for even people who don't necessarily follow the issue on a day-to-day basis. So that's just a plug. I mean, that's a plug for following his particular blog at Climate Progress.
Right, exactly. He's been kind of on this and doing great work on that for some time. Let me just, before we talk about, because I want to also get to how all of this affects the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is something that, you know, is dear to the hearts of many environmentalists. I've covered it on the program as well as in my Facebook, you know, reporting and curation and everything, and very, you know, and that'll be our next topic. But before we get there, let's just put one further question about, you know, the current topic to rest, which is, you know, here we're talking about exploration in Russia. And, you know, has it suddenly become that, you know, and yet, you know, Russia, the fear that there and the suspicion that the election outcome could be due to intervention by Russia, you know, has now become oddly for me to see, given, you know, the history of red scaremongering and other things, you know, in the United States, has now become a liberal left or a democratic issue. And now, you know, the Republicans are, you know, kind of friendly and champions of Russia. Is that a accurate, I think that's what a lot of people have come to think, but is that an accurate representation of where this sits? And, you know, here we are, in this juncture where, you know, Putin has become both the demon and the hope of the Democratic Party, in that, you know, the concern that he, you know, has meddled with the American election, possibly to get these deals through. Who knows what his reasoning would be if he were in fact doing it. You know, what is your view of that? Because the whole, now when you say Russia, all of the Democrats are, you know, terrified of and you know, accusing Russia. And here we know that, you know, the Trump administration has economic affiliations and ties with Russia. And in fact, so did Secretary Clinton. In fact, and her foundation have ties with Russia. So can you clear that up a little bit just before we move on to the other topic?
Yeah, sure. And I'll also clarify one other thing. I mentioned that dystopian show. The name of it that Matt Damon is the executive producer of is called Incorporated, just for listeners in case they're interested in checking out the show. It's on the Sci-Fi Network. But when you're to your question itself, it is a little bit of an unbelievable situation that we're dealing with right now, in that we're you know, the accusations are that Russia tipped the scales of the election in favor of Trump, but the accusations are being made mostly based on some anonymous sources, at least currently the current ones, that they actually did it in favor of Trump, not just that they intervened, but that it was not they intervened and it was to tip the balance for Trump. That's based on anonymous CIA sources that went to the Washington Post, not the CIA officially, not the other intelligence agencies that are part of the U.S. bureaucracy. So that is the basis for all of this media fallout that's occurred since that story came out. I believe it was on a Friday before the weekend, or maybe it was on Saturday. But that's sort of the basis of everything that's come since. Of course, there was already Putin was very much in play before that, and Russia, and the ties between the friendly ties between Trump and Putin, that was in play long before that. But the most current iteration of that is based on that Washington Post story. So I think that's a little bit important to point out. I'm trying to think of a way to say it. I think that, this is sort of every moment. I think there's so much fear over Trump that right now there's the push for the Electoral College Monday, that vote takes place on December 19th. And a lot of the rhetoric about that is based on Putin and Russia and the hacking and all of that. But I think we're going to see that again, even after that takes place with the inauguration. And I think that it regardless of anything else, I don't think it's very safe rhetoric to be talking about another country sort of in this type of way, this sort of Red Scare type of language that it is inflaming relations right now. At the same time that Russia's being embraced more by potentially President-elect Trump, and there might be a reset in relations. The rhetoric of the Democrats and of liberals, I just don't think that it's very sort of healthy language and sort of a healthy way to be talking about another country necessarily. A lot of it is based on, I think, a Cold War type of nostalgia, but there's a lot of hypocrisy embedded in it. For example, we almost never hear Saudi Arabia talked about in the same way as Russia, for example, even though it's very, obviously very much a dictatorship, very much a monarchy, very much not at all a democracy, even less so than Russia by comparison. And it's never talked about in that way. Although, President Clinton, or sorry, candidate Clinton and her foundation had close ties with Saudi Arabia. Every president in the past several decades has maintained close relations with Saudi Arabia. Obviously, another petro state in the same way as Russia is, produces a lot of oil and gas. The main global producer of oil and gas in the world is Saudi Arabia. And we give hundreds of millions of dollars in weapons to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia, by the way, has an alliance, is in line with ISIS. And so that's, that's going on. We don't hear even, right now, currently, we don't even hear close to as much conversation about, that as one example. So I think that we really have to put this in perspective, and that there is no kind of smoking gun evidence to date that it was Russia actually actively trying to tip the scales in favor of Trump. It may be the case, but that it's still being investigated. And I think that it's kind of crazy, because people are saying that the members of the Electoral College should be briefed. I've seen this, should be briefed by the CIA, give a briefing about Russia intervened. But the CIA hasn't even officially said that. This was some anonymous sources within the CIA. There's no, if you go to the CIA website, there's no official statement by the CIA because it's not something that the agency at large has embraced. It's just something mm-hmm. that someone, you know, so it's, who knows who these anonymous sources are or what their agenda was. It's very sketchy to write a whole story based on claims of anonymous sources. So it's, there's just so much murkiness in all of this. And I think that a lot of this is based on trying to discredit Trump. There's plenty to talk about with him and who he's picking now. And we'll be talking about it for years to come. But I just think that this could have, I think that it's, I don't know if it could be long-term ramifications, but at the same time, it looks like there's a reset going, but I just don't think it's a very healthy sort of rhetorical track to go down. I think that, I think people like you and me, we've been questioning it, but there's just so much momentum going the other way by from mainstream liberal pundits beating the drum on this, that it's a little bit eerie, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear that. I mean, since when are liberals, I mean, does the term have any meaning when liberals become the ones, to be listening to, anonymous sources of the CIA? And, I mean, I understand we don't like Trump and everything, but it goes to, I don't like him, obviously. I don't like what we're discussing today at all. But it goes to the question of where is democratic process, in all of this. So there's a way in which if we don't stick with fundamentals of an independent and free press, if we don't stick with fundamentals, then, we're calling ourselves liberal. But what does that actually mean if we lose our radar, our sense of direction, if we're just kind of reactively operating in a chaos? And, by that, I'm not saying that I hope Trump gets into office. Obviously, I don't. But, at some point, you have to look at the ramifications of what you will accept and what the effects of it are, which, as you suggest, and I've been concerned about it as well, it becomes functionally a kind of warmongering with a major nation, mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. in another case, we're just winking, at a detrimental relationship with negative ramifications for terrorism and other things in the United States. Anyway, I think all of that is, people should be thoughtful about it. And, again, being driven by fear, as terrifying as all of this is entirely understandable. But whether it's going to really get us to the outcome we need is really a big question.
It's at the bottom of it is, I think, what's something we agree on is that whatever route is going to be taken going forward on this issue and others, it needs to be based on sort of facts that you can point to, not just claims of anonymous sources. It's good. Obama has called for an investigation. Both branches of Congress have called for an investigation. An investigation is a good thing, but that investigation hasn't ensued yet. While that investigation is ensuing and we wait for the results, right now the claims are being based on these anonymous sources. So I think that the bottom line is that we need to make any claims or any sort of strategies or any way we think about the world, and it really should be based on real facts that we can point to. I think that it's so basic to say that, but that's really not taking place insofar as this whole situation with Russia and most of the chatter about it goes. So
mm-hmm.
I just thought.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that one. Now we have about not quite 15 minutes left to our program today, but I did want to touch upon another one of the nominations, namely the one, for Energy Secretary, which also has direct impact on our area. If you could comment on that and just so we can cover that not as thoroughly as we have this earlier topic, but they are obviously related.
Yeah, definitely. So the pick for that, which came on the same day as Tillerson, was former Texas Governor Rick Perry, the Republican governor who has run for president himself two times, both during the 2012 and during the 2016 election cycles. And he was named Secretary of Energy, I should say, despite the fact that one of his biggest political gaffes of his entire career was actually forgetting the name of the agency during one of the debates. Maybe he was just nervous or whatever. I'm sure he knows what the Department of Energy is, but it was, it's called his oops moment, because actually in the debate, he was talking about which agencies he would get rid of. And he listed two of them before he was about to say Department of Energy. And then he forgot. And he said, oops, I forgot. And so that's known as Rick Perry's oops moment. So now he's going to head up.
Ironic.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, but sort of ironic that now he's leading the very agency that he said that if he were president, he would have gotten rid of course, people who run for office, say all kinds of things, and then do different things when they actually get power. So he will head up the Department of Energy. Of course, Texas is a massive oil and gas producing state. Eagle Ford Shale, Barnett Shale, Permian Basin. Rick Perry was governor during when the fracking boom really took off in Texas, he was governor really during that whole decade where it took off in Texas. So kind of directly responsible for overseeing that sort of stuff as the governor through the agencies that he was in charge of. So he's very oil and gas friendly guy, on the record as a climate change denier. But I think that the thing that you probably want to, your listeners would be really interested in, and people who've been following the Dakota Access Pipeline fight would be interested to hear, is that Rick Perry, after he left office as governor, became a member of the board of directors of Energy Transfer Partners, which is the owner of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So that's a job that he gets paid over $250,000 a year for to do, just being sitting on the board and being involved in meetings and all the everything that goes into being on the board. That's what gets paid over $250,000 a year for that. And that was actually something that came up. He was asked about it during a town hall meeting when he was running in 2015, when he was still a candidate. And he was in Iowa, which is one of the states that that pipeline would go through if it actually opens up for business. Starts in North Dakota in the Bakken Shale, goes through South Dakota, and then Iowa, gets bisected diagonally, and then terminates in Illinois and intersects with a different pipeline that would go down to the Gulf Coast. But he was asked about it in Iowa at a town hall and basically said that his sort of running as for president, his ties to the board of Energy Transfer Partners was quote unquote irrelevant, because Iowa was a state that would get to decide that. And that's technically true. And their utilities board did decide to approve that pipeline. So just like all the other states. That was his answer, gave sort of another sort of general statement about why infrastructure is important, why pipelines are important, gave examples of different infrastructure generally that he had oversight of when he was governor of Texas. So, Rick Perry, Secretary of Energy, if he gets through. And I feel like his him being named to that position has been a little bit less controversial. I haven't heard as much. I mean, obviously, the people are not happy about it in the environmental community, but it's been a little bit, I think because it happened on the same day as Tillerson, and also because everyone else has been so controversial, that Perry has gotten by with, at least for now, with a little bit less scrutiny. Tillerson's been dominating the news cycle, and before that was the guy who was named for EPA, which is Scott Pruitt, who's another climate change denier, Attorney General of Oklahoma. And so just between Tillerson and then Pruitt, it's already, like, so overwhelming. I think that Rick Perry has sort of slipped through with quite a bit less media attention, although it's still been, obviously he's been covered, but not in the same way, not in the same probing way as the other two. And I think that that will probably change, but it's going to be sort of one of those things. Do you fight every nomination, or are they going to pick a couple that they feel are really bad? Democrats have come out in Congress pretty much saying that they're going to oppose all of these nominations. But I feel like probably Tillerson is the only one who that'll be a really sticky hearing. Pruitt will be pretty controversial, but the Republican Party is obviously very much in line with climate change denial and everything that Pruitt stands for, so I don't expect anyone to cross party lines on that one. But Tillerson, I do feel like that's a very sticky situation, and not because of the climate change stuff, even though I feel like that's the most important, just because of people like McCain and Lindsey Graham are Russia hawks, and so they are concerned about his ties to Russia and the potential Russia reshift in U.S. policy under a potential Trump administration. So I think that'll be something to watch for. Is I think that the most contentious hearing will be Tillerson, but Pruitt will be up there as well. And I think that because of that, someone like Prairie will sneak through with quite a bit less contentiousness than would normally be the case, despite his own track record, which is not that much different than someone like Pruitt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, probably,
a caller actually calling in. So we only have seven or so more minutes, but let's take that call and see what the question is. This is David calling in from San Francisco.
Hey, morning. You know, I was interested, I heard you talking about that polar vortex a little bit ago, and if I remember right, 2 or 3 years ago, when there was another one of these polar vortexes, it basically was something that had happened on the opposite side of the world. There was a massive typhoon that had started in the Philippines, gone straight up the Pacific to Alaska, and then crashed into the polar vortex, and then that pushed a massive amount of cold air straight down America into Texas. So I've been looking online trying to figure out what was the cause of this one, if it was a similar thing, or is there a new phenomena that's happening?
I haven't seen too much of a studious reaction to this particular polar vortex, but if you search around for the cause or the contributing factors to the polar vortex that did happen a couple of years ago, I was living in Wisconsin at the time, and it was terrible. It was like temperatures of 40 below zero wind chill for weeks on end.
It was even worse in a way because it made like 8 feet of snow, and then that snow melted in about 2 days, so it lost a lot of topsoil and caused a lot of flooding. So I'm thinking, too, you know, when you start looking at this pipeline they're laying in, there it's going to cross waterways and 200 waterways, and then, massive flooding. What are the chances that it would rip through some of the architecture of these pipelines with massive flooding? So, if global warming and polar vortex crashes are going to create similar conditions, you know, we've got to start looking at architectural standards being vastly increased.
That's a really good question, and thank you
sure.
very much for that, David. You know, I know they've tried to look at the architecture, but, you know, what always happens is that there are certain innate problems in the pipelines, and building for safety is something that's fought at the regulatory level that then has to be enforced. And that's where, you know, the problems of making those kinds of changes, it's very intransigent. Your comments on that, Steve?
Yeah, I think that all infrastructure in general not with a capital A-L-L, but most infrastructure is at risk in some ways and in sort of unpredictable ways because of the impacts of climate change or increasingly bad polar vortexes or whatever other weather factors end up happening. I think that's why a lot of thinkers on this issue have called for quote-unquote resilience or sort of building a society that is resilient to the impacts of climate change.
Mm-hmm.
So things like pipelines or roads or other critical infrastructure are very much at risk because of the potential ravages of climate change. Things like polar vortexes, again, here in the Midwest or what have you, flooding on the coast, et cetera. I think one, you know, just because you got me thinking about it, you know, some, sort of the agencies that we think about that are not talked about as much, like, in, you know, on the mainstream media, it'll be very interesting to see what kind of person Trump picks to head an agency, say, like the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration, or the person who oversees pipelines, or an agency like FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, agencies that are covered in the niche press, people who follow this stuff very closely but might not necessarily get covered on cable TV. I think, you know, these are not choices that he's made yet, but I'll be interested to see what kind of people get chosen. We already know that these are very much positions that ended up going to people with industry connections and industry ties, regardless of party. So we'll just see what Trump ends up doing on that. Yeah. So, but
yeah, that's a good one. Actually, we're coming to the end of our show, but actually next week's program is going to be about, you know, a FERC-approved pipeline through a decaying nuclear power plant, a topic I've covered multiple times on this show. So this is actually, I don't usually promo the next show, but, you know, here's our great opportunity, because we will be talking a lot about FERC in the next week's program. You know, and you're right about that. People need to know more about that, because they are behind the scenes as the, you know, supposed regulator, but in fact are an industry pocket agency, you know, sub agency.
Of the industry, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on Connect the Dots today, Steve Horn. It's just been a pleasure having you. We'll have to have you back multiple times. And I want to alert listeners to follow Steve on DSmog blog. You know, he reports regularly on all of these topics. His, you know, he's doing yeoman's work, really, and has been for quite some time. So, you know, please do follow him and read his stuff. There are articles on the topics that we discussed today up on DSmog blog right now, and also delving into his past reporting is an, you know, complete education in itself. Thank you so much, Steve, for joining me today on Connect the Dots.
Thanks for having me, and look forward to coming back on sometime. Really appreciate
it. For sure. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today on Connect the Dots. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well.
Somewhere,